5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Model Moon!
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On this moon mission, we talk to producer of Bitcoin and Friends, Robert Allen. We learn about his upbringing and how he was homeschooled. And we compare that to his feelings about public schools. We also take a deep dive on socialism and get his true feelings about what he thinks it really is at its very core. We learn about his financial and economic awakening, how he discovered crypto, and what he thinks about the crypto space in 2020 and different projects. We also get his take on where he sees Bitcoin dominance. And of course, we discuss the amazing show Bitcoin and Friends and our favorite character, B, who barfs up itty-bitties in 10-minute intervals, and come mid-May of 2020, he'll be barfing up exactly half as many every 10 minutes. But on the dark side of the Huddle Moon, we'll still be tuning in to catch the very latest episode of Bitcoin and Friends.
I want some ice cream, ice cream, ice cream.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantech's. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com.
Huddle Moon!
All right, and we're back with another episode of Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well today, Cade. Actually, we've got an exciting guest. This is going to be one of the best shows that we've done so far. I'm sure that lots of you have heard of this show. It's called BTC and Friends. So we're here today with Robert. How are you doing today, Robert?
Great, Josh.
Great. So thanks. Robert is actually the executive producer of Bitcoin and Friends. But before we get into the show, we want to go a little bit to the backstory of Robert Allen. So who are you? Where are you from? What's your interesting quirks and tidbits that we can get into before we discuss the show? I'm sure the audience would love to know. Cool. So how are you doing today, Robert?
I'm really good. Thank you. How far back do we want to go here?
Hey, Cade loves going way back.
Oh, I would just say take it wherever you want to go, but maybe like where you grew up, like what you're like in high school, like the hobbies, what you studied, and I'll, you know, take it wherever you want to go with it.
Sure. Okay. Well, I guess probably it's important to note that I was a homeschool kid, one of those weird homeschool kids. No, but really, there were quite a few slightly strange homeschoolers. We actually had like a homeschooling group that would meet, and so you had all sorts. We had Mennonites, we had a lot of very very religious folk, but generally speaking, very nice people. Actually, I don't want to denigrate the people that we associate with, but anyway, so I was born and raised in Ohio. My family is fairly religious, Protestant, evangelical. So I think that was part of the impetus for my parents wanting to homeschool their children. My mother was educated as an elementary school teacher, so she did have a bit of training, and I think that definitely helped quite a bit. I really enjoyed being homeschooled. You know, it was kind of like we would do structured lessons for the first half of the day for a few hours, basically in the morning. And then the afternoons, I was generally free to do whatever I wanted to do. So it's kind of like I had a half day of school versus most kids were stuck in seats, you know, for 7 or 8 or however many hours. And I think that really benefited me a lot because it just gave me a lot of confidence that if I had interest in a topic, I could go to a library, I could find a book, I could jump into it. And so that's translated to me being, kind of fluid in my career in terms of jumping in and out of a lot of different things and kind of playing around in different professions. So into high school, I did end up moving into a private school, a Christian school for my high school years, which was nice. You know, it was a small, like 50, roughly 50 student class per class. It was a lot of freedom again there, small class size. So a lot of opportunity to do different things. Really enjoyed art at that point in my life was really enjoying art classes. I started getting into music when I was in middle school, especially in drumming and then playing guitar and other things. So for a while, I guess I would have considered myself to be sort of an aspiring like professional musician. That was my goal at that point in life. Played around recording songs and releasing, self-made music for quite a while there. Then into college, went to Ohio State University. 1 year I ended up going down to Nashville, Tennessee, and went to Belmont University, which was a very expensive, is a very expensive private school. I believe it's still operating. And that was probably a bit of a mistake. I think I borrowed close to $20,000. which was really not smart. And I think when I was accepted into the school, I was brought in as a commercial voice major, whatever the hell that is. And so, and then I think about, to my credit, I think after the first day of classes in that major, I realized that this was an insane proposition, that there were, probably over 100, 200 students in this major. It could have even been more. I don't remember exactly, but there were a lot of students and they were all dead set on being pop stars. And obviously the numbers just don't work out. There are not that many pop stars that you can have several hundred graduating every year, making a career out of it. So I sobered up a bit and switched to music business, which was a bit smarter of a move. But again, this was right around the time of Napster and basically the music industry imploding. I was actually reading an article today, and I think it was somewhere in the range of like, I think it was 15 to 18 billion was the market at that point. And then when Napster happened, it dropped below, I think, 8 billion, 8 to 10, if I remember right, was the low in 2010. So that market, that whole industry really got decimated. It started to come back a little now because of Spotify and some of these streaming services. But anyway, so it was definitely bad timing to get into the music industry. And so after that first year at Belmont, with all of that debt piling up, I sobered up completely and moved back to Ohio and finished off my undergraduate as an English major. And I basically picked that because it was, I think, the quickest way for me to graduate. And I think even then I kind of realized that the whole thing was a bit of a scam, but I was already so far into it that I felt like I had to.
So you mean university was a scam, right?
Sure.
The old
sure.
sunk cost fallacy.
Right. Yeah. Of course. And that was probably a mistake even then, but I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, I ended up, so I graduated as an English major from Ohio State, and then a buddy of mine, I didn't know what I was going to do. Cause again, what's an English degree give you? Really not much.
You can teach.
Right. So that's what I did. So a buddy of mine was joining up with this program called the New York City Teaching Fellows. And he told me all about it, and it sounded interesting. And basically, they would pay for you to teach while they also put you through a program to get your master's in education. I think when the program originally started, it was almost like kind of elite in the sense that you would get put through like NYU or I think Columbia. So that, they were sending students to really good schools. by the time I got into it, they were shuffling shuffling the fellows off to schools like Mercy College, which is like a community college in the Bronx, basically.
How did you find teaching? I did my homework here. I saw you taught in looks like Bronx and Spanish Harlem. How did you find it teaching in the inner city?
Well, it wasn't like any of those starry-eyed Hollywood movies that you see, where the teacher goes in and all the kids, you know, their lives are immediately changed.
You didn't change the world, Robert? Are you kidding me?
With your mind, gangster's paradise.
I failed. No, you know, it was tough, obviously. I mean, I had first year in Spanish Harlem, you know, so basically they just throw you into these classrooms. I had a summer's worth of training, which of course is never enough, but it's not really even about training. Like, you could probably be trained for a decade and it wouldn't make a difference, because you're basically a glorified jailer, is essentially what I came to realize as I, you know, as I worked my way through that system. So I was teaching special education and general education, even though I was supposed to be a special education teacher. So they were already like shuffling teachers into positions and roles they really weren't even supposed to be in. But anyway, so I had a gen ed English class, in one in particular, where I couldn't turn my back away from the students because they would throw books at me. and you know, I'm sure for them it was a lot of fun.
For you, that sounds like hell. That sounds like hell to me.
Oh yeah, it was. I felt sometimes like I was in prison and I had been locked in with, you know, the crazy people,
and they were your students were the prison guards.
Right, exactly. The whole dynamic had been flipped. No, in many ways it was true, because you know, you couldn't really do anything in terms of discipline. There was no, you had very little power. You couldn't even really kick kids out of your class, because if you did that, you know, maybe once or twice, like an assistant principal would help you. But the kids knew that eventually, like, they would get worn down and then they just get put back in the classroom. And so, you know, you basically just had to make sure that, you know, like, no one murdered anyone. And, you know, like, and that I wasn't maimed or something. And then, you know, in terms of teaching, that was pretty far down the line of priorities, just because there was no order in the rooms. And so basically the big picture, I guess, for those who are maybe not familiar with the inner city schools, is that you have, I would say, at least half of the students I worked with. So these were middle school, you know, eighth, ninth grade kids, seventh. I think I had a few seventh graders. But anyway, I'd say half were, and this is not just like conjecture, this was based on observation and testing and so on, but half of the students I worked with were illiterate and or innumerate, typically both. I would say easily 50%. And so, I mean, to the point where, you know, literally they could potentially sight read, quote, read a few words, but, you know, like they might know the word star, but if you put, you know, star craft, or, you know, I mean, like you pick a word and you add something to it, they had no idea what that was, which shows that they had no phonetic, understanding really at all. And, you know, basic, like multiplication for many of them was completely out of the question.
Can I jump in here? That reminds me, because my other half, she works at a school, and she was teaching kids that were in the seventh grade, but they had math skills of like first or second grade, and they were learning their multiplication tables, and they're learning their twos and their ones. They're learning their ones multiplication table, and at the top of the multiplication table, he got it all wrong, but he wrote in really cool letters. You got to know your multiplication tables to swag.
Exactly. Yeah. So you know, that's about exactly the sort of situation that I found myself in.
What age were these people? What's the typical age range that you were dealing
Were you in middle school or high school?
Yeah, middle school. So 7th, 8th, 9th. I guess 9th was technically high school. So, they kind of shuffled all around.
So, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-olds around there.
Yeah, exactly. Although some of them, I think I had some 16-year-olds because they were held back a few years. So, that even compounded things more, made things more difficult because, you basically had adults that were in these rooms with children. And obviously they're physically very, very different in terms of size and so on. So that can create strange dynamics.
How much did this influence your kind of way of thinking? Because you've obviously come around a little bit to more of the, libertarian anarchist type of thinking. So was this inner city result of, this well-intentioned government plan to help the inner cities? Was that some type of influence for you in terms of thinking, wow, this really doesn't work, we need another way?
Definitely, yes. So I think to kind of frame that would be that I grew up, like I had mentioned earlier, conservative Christian, and pretty much kind of the old school conservative, don't question the government, vote Republican. The Bushes are God's people. Not really a lot of thinking beyond sort of the party line. And in retrospect, as I get older, I do see a lot of value in certain conservative principles and ideals. But like with a lot of ideologies, if they're followed without thought, I think they can become very dangerous. And I think the conservative side has its share of pitfalls. And so, as I got into college, I had started to see hypocrisies and things that just didn't really make a lot of sense to me within the church. I had been a devout Christian. I had actually worked in churches, teaching and leading worship and leading groups and doing all sorts of things from basically high school into early college. But obviously with the university system, I was, kind of thrust into, it was, a lot of the liberalism that I guess you would expect from American universities. And I think I bought a lot of that kind of hook, line, and sinker. And so I thought, hey, I'm going to go to this big city and I'm going to help these disadvantaged people. And, the answer to all of this is just educating people. And it's just all these really simple tropes and a lot of nonsense.
From one extreme to the other. One sense of utopianism to the other, a complete end of the spectrum.
Yeah, that's true.
That's quite interesting. So you've gone from really deeply conservative religious values to having these very, very progressive left-wing type of living it and going to the inner cities and being disillusioned ultimately with both. So that was very interesting. And then how did you come around then? So let's bring this conversation back a little bit. How did you come around to deciding, okay, well, this doesn't work on the other end. So what brought you into, was it libertarian circles that introduced you to cryptocurrency? And how did you first get involved with Bitcoin?
Yeah, so I mean, just to summarize, or I guess finish the public education piece. I obviously started seeing firsthand, how things were not working at all according to what I had been taught in university, and that a lot of these explanations and sort of like the liberal guilt really didn't lead to anything beneficial, and probably actually is not probably it is very, very detrimental, because you actually you teach a class of people that they are the victims, and that it's these other quote advantaged typically white people who are to blame for all of your problems, and then you create this sort of class division I started reading into my second year of teaching, because obviously I was very disillusioned by it all and realized how broken the whole thing was. I started reading John Taylor Gatto. He wrote a book called Dumbing Us Down and several others. And for anyone interested in any of these topics, I highly recommend his works. He was a New York City public school teacher for, 40 years.
I've seen his videos on YouTube. He's got some really long kind of documentary style interviews where he has a long interview and then the interviewer then cuts in some clips to give context and help the audience understand his point. So yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that's a great recommendation. We'll add that in the show notes afterwards. So that's a really good point. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, carry on.
No, it's fine. And I didn't realize he had videos. Maybe those came out after I had read his books or something. But anyway, so all of that really, kind of started pushing me pretty heavily in the direction of libertarianism. Although I think at that point I didn't quite know it. But, you know, a lot of these things I think also were kind of buried under the surface in my psyche, you know, because there are a lot of overlaps between conservative thought, especially certain branches, and even Christianity and libertarianism. You know, sort of a skepticism and a sense that the government can do bad things, and that you know that we should be wary and we should be cautious. I think that sentiment is there to some degree.
That's true. If I could jump in, they always say that statism is the religion of atheists. You know, they think it can do no wrong and it's going to change the world. But I think Christians tend to be, at least in the U.S., skeptical of the government, the same way that someone who is a libertarian or a minarchist or an anarchist would also be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I couldn't agree with you more. I noticed really a religious fervor and inability to really face reality from the administrators and the people that I worked with in these schools. And it really was the same kind of religious zealotry that had kind of repelled me from certain aspects of Christianity. So I became disillusioned, read some Gatto and a few other authors, and finally realized that, you know, there's very little that I could do. My third year, I was actually making some progress with some students. I had I was a sets teacher, which is basically like a pull-out instruction, small group kind of setup. And I started using a program called the Spalding Method for teaching phonics. And I saw kids with kindergarten, first grade reading levels make pretty dramatic improvement, like several grade levels in 6 months time improvement, which was really exciting. And same with math, I'd found some tools, basically just really pushing hard on remediating basic math skills. And I started to see some playing some board games and some other things that, especially for the boys, was really an easy way to get them interested in math. I was playing some strategy games with probability and dice and stuff. So anyway, that was an interesting year. And then I took the results of what I've been doing and recommendations to my principals at the school, and of course, sadly, they basically just dismissed all of these things and said, "Well, we have to focus on these tests, and we have state testing, and you know,
they have a certain system, don't they? They have to you got to use this teaching method or that teaching method. We got to teach to the test. You know, we got to get the funding. You know, there's all these different things that are preventing you from actually being a good teacher."
Right. Right. And I think ultimately what I believe now, and this is basically what Gatto teaches or talks about, is that the school system we have is a Prussian model that was designed to educate people to a point that they could work in factories. And that system really does not work anymore. It may be even more nefarious than that. It could really be a desire to keep the population dumbed down, quite literally. Yeah.
I don't know if Gatto said this or someone else, but like some theories are like, we want them just to smart enough to work in the factories, but not smart enough to know what's going on.
Right, right. I think that is the sense that I got from my time in that whole system, is that it's not designed to encourage real understanding and knowledge and efficacy. It's sort of it's designed to hobble people intentionally, I think.
And I think a lot of
Kate.
Well, I think a lot of smart people know that too. You know, Elon Musk, I think he set up his own school for his kids because he realized that, like you said, school can be a prison for some kids.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so around that time, I also started watching presidential debates with Ron Paul. was one of the candidates. So this was in 2007. And I was immediately drawn to what he was saying. He seemed to be, I think, in the for the first time in my life, a politician who was speaking truth. Like I really, I could see that what he was saying made a lot of sense, and that he wasn't speaking in sort of the traditional political doublespeak that you hear so often. So that really got me kind of pushed into the libertarian rabbit hole. And then I started reading books about economics as well, and read some books by Peter Schiff initially, and then some others, obviously Rothbard being one of the big ones. His book, For a New Liberty, I think is the one that made me realize, well, it was the first sort of anarcho-capitalist writing that I had read. And it made a lot of sense. It made me realize that a lot of the systems that we just take for granted are made by humans. They are, you know, they are constructs that we have all been taught to believe are necessary and can never be replaced or could never be reimagined. And, you know, he did a really good job in that book of laying out, like, you know, for example, law enforcement, the idea that we have to have a central state to protect property rights. And he lays out, I think, very, very well, the idea that you could have competing private police services that could provide the same service and arguably do it in a much better and more cost efficient manner.
Yeah, with less dead people and less dead dogs, too.
Right, right. And so that book in particular was a real eye opener. And then I started getting into reading some of the works of Ludwig von Mises, such as Socialism, where he really tears apart socialism and explains why it cannot work, because there's no pricing model available in that system, and so there's no way for the market to determine what needs to be produced. And in what quantities. And, you know, so, you know, all of these things, I think for anyone out there who's skeptical or, you know, maybe we're preaching to the choir, hopefully not. But, you know, if you're listening and you would consider yourself to be a socialist, I highly recommend, well, Socialism is a great book, although it's very long. So you'll have to really have some guts to dig into that. But Economics in One Lesson is probably one of the best first books to read if you're curious about all this stuff. And that was another one that I found to be really instructive.
Yeah. So Robert, if you're against socialism, does that mean you hate poor people or?
Well, no, you know, it's of course ironic that, well,
we don't hate poor people, by the way, just in case you've got no idea about context, people listening.
No, yeah. not at all. And I think, unfortunately, that a lot of times in life, truth is complicated and nuanced. And it's easy to, you know, go out there and promise rainbows and butterflies and utopia to people. And do it under the guise of wanting to help people. It's really sad in many ways. Even just the term socialism to me is unfortunate, because it's not social. It's very antisocial, actually.
Yeah. I mean, if the fruits of socialism are not very, well, you can look back at history, that it's not very pretty, really. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And honestly, socialism is one of those utopian ideas. We've had some people on the show in the past that are from Venezuela, and they've, you know, they've lived through it, and you know, seeing the well-intentioned beginnings and then always the disastrous ending. Like, you can see what happens when they hold on to power at all costs. I mean, look what's happening in China right now with the coronavirus, people getting welded into their apartments because the government doesn't want to talk about what's happening, arresting doctors for revealing the truth because you might make the party men lose face. I mean, right. That type of thing happens. There's a guy, Peter Hitchens, who is the brother of the more famous Hitchens that you probably know, Christopher,
sure.
The United States. And he talks about this. He was actually he was a Trotskyite as he was a youth. And he actually went to live in Russia, and he saw firsthand the hypocrisy of living in a communist society where all of the people at the upper echelons of the party would basically have dinner parties every evening and have the best food and drink, while the other people, the common people in the streets, would basically be lining up for bread. And like you mentioned about the pricing problem, we talked about that on a previous show. I mean, in the last days of the Soviet Union, you had people, people in rooms just copying the prices out of the Sears catalog because they had no idea how to price stuff. So, I mean, it doesn't work, fellas.
And to be fair, I should say, this is kind of a truism that I like, which is, you know, if you're not a socialist when you're 18, you don't have a heart. You know, if you're not a libertarian / conservative, whatever you want to say in that direction, when you're 25, 30, you don't have a brain. Yeah. And I really think that's true. But, I had no idea. I was a naive kid. You know, when I was, 20, I think it was, 2021, I was in Mexico for a Spanish language program, you know, studying Spanish. And, I bought a Che Guevara t-shirt because he looked cool and, you know, power to the people, you know, and, I'll never forget. I was on the flight back to the States, and a brave and intelligent woman just, you know, stopped me on the plane and said, basically, do you know who that man is and what he did?
Do you know how many gay people he killed and how many blacks that he persecuted? And you're like, oh, wait a second, this doesn't fit the narrative I've been fed. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So she shook me a little bit. And we all need to do that because it's easy to fall into these camps without really looking very, very closely at the history and to just buy these simple narratives. It's not that simple. Another thing that I've been thinking a lot about lately that ties into this is just this idea that socialism, communism, these authoritarian structures, to me, it's kind of like it's synonymous with the idea of if all of a sudden one day, you know, just a very small part of your brain decided to take over for the entire thing, right? So if you're only using 2 centimeters, let's say, of your brain and the rest is on vacation, I think you're quickly going to find out that your life is going to be very difficult. You're going to be stumbling around. You're not going to be able to talk or think or really do anything. And this, I think, is a good analogy for what statism, communism, socialism, all of these authoritarian systems ultimately are about. It's about a small group of people with a lot of hubris believing that they can dictate complex financial and monetary and otherwise economic systems, by fiat, and we can't expect a handful of people to be able to dictate the complexities of a market. So, yeah.
All right, cool. So that makes a lot of sense. I mean, ultimately, this is how many of us came to this type of conclusion, that a lot of us started off very left-leaning when we are young, and then you get a bit older and a few light bulbs go off, like, hold on, the government can't possibly do everything, even if we try our best and everyone puts their best foot forward and they're all trying. Ultimately, it's a different type of belief that you have. It's another replacement for religion, mm-hmm, almost. Mm-hmm. And then many people start to believe in alternative ways of doing things. Some people go way to the deep end and they're like, all right, we're going to be anarchists now, which also I think is a bit of a fallacy, mm-hmm, too, because it requires everybody to be on the same wavelength in order for that to actually work. And honestly, most people are not ready for that type of paradigm shift. Sure. So I think that the best way to come around is through voluntary action. And I think that's what libertarians call for, is basically you do what you want to do as long as the other people are not being harmed. You're not harming other people deliberately and they're not harming you, then live and let live, so to speak. It's almost the easiest way to live. And it goes almost back to the Ten Commandments, or some of the old teachings in the sure. Bible where they say, like, you know, live and let live, or do unto others as I do unto you, and things like that. So I think that is how many people get into this type of decentralized world, this dissatisfaction with what's happened in centralized systems. Yes. I think that's where you're going here. Is that right?
Definitely.
When was the first time, or what was the first moment that you introduced to Bitcoin and cryptocurrency?
So basically what happened after the 3 years of teaching is I had gotten into libertarianism and Austrian economics. That's the term for those who aren't familiar with this kind of whole school of thought, Austrian economic thought. And so I actually ended up finding a job with Peter Schiff's company, Euro-Pacific Precious Metals. They've renamed it to Schiff Gold. But I worked for Peter for about 4 years at that point, moving out of teaching. And that was a really great experience, you know, very eye-opening in many ways. Made pretty good money for a few years, which was also very helpful. And of course, you know, it fell pretty far down the gold rabbit hole. And we won't need to get into all of that. But yeah.
We're fans of gold too. You know, obviously we know what Peter's views on crypto are these days, but what was it like working for him? Was he a nice boss? Did you like it there?
Yeah, I did. You know, Peter has a lot of businesses that he operates, so he wasn't like day-to-day present. We would see him occasionally at, you know, at like parties, and occasionally he'd come into the office. But yeah, I mean, he's a nice gentleman. I have no problem, you know, with him. Liked working for his company, you know, it was good. But you know, during that time, I think I realized that the narrative for the gold bugs is basically that somehow, let me phrase it in the way that I would see it today, which is that we were on a gold standard. It was working well. So the gold standard comes to an end in 1971. And then the sort of narrative for gold bugs today is that somehow governments are going to be compelled, or we're going to convince them that we need to go back to a gold standard. And I think really the reason the gold standard ended is because it's difficult for people to, you know, protect their gold, to hold it. So they tend to put it into vaults and banks. And then that's basically, these are nice honeypots for governments to come along and to seize that gold and to control it. So in other words, I think gold is, even though it was and is still in many ways a very good form of money, it's flawed in some ways. And I think Bitcoin is quite a bit better and addressing some of those issues. And so when I heard about Bitcoin, well, I heard about it in 2011, but sadly, like a lot of folks, I didn't give it the time of day. I thought that, you know, digital items could not be scarce. I had never seen anything along the lines of a digitally scarce item, so I didn't really pay attention. I mean, I just thought it had to have been a scam. And but anyway, in 2013, I saw it popping up in the news again, and I thought, well, maybe I should actually take a look at this, what's going on, you know, just out of curiosity, and finally read the Bitcoin white paper, which made quite a bit of sense, even though I don't have an extremely technical background. I think it's written well enough that even non-technical people can understand it. And so it really got me thinking quite a bit about, well, basically what dawned on me was that this technology could be the answer to our problems, and could be you know, the touchstone that could move us away from centrally planned economies and central banking and all of these terrible, terrible systems. And so I got really excited by that. And within about, I don't know, 6 or so months, I ended up quitting the precious metals brokerage job and started, you know, just kind of full-time into Bitcoin, and got pulled also, like a lot of people, into the broader, you know, quote, cryptocurrency market, which is, that's another big topic. But You know, I think overall, it's inevitable there's going to be a lot of different competing technologies, but I think Bitcoin has proven itself over the last several years to have the right monetary policy and to have the credibility that it needs to ultimately win this competition. And I think the Lightning Network is working well enough. I've played around with it. It definitely has some rough edges and some things that need to be worked out. But I can see Lightning Network working well enough to scale this technology to be used as a payment system. So I'm really more excited about Bitcoin than I ever have been. And I'm just, you know, thrilled to be alive to see all of this happening and hopefully to help push it forward a little bit. And so that's, I guess, what part of the impetus for starting the show, which is, I guess, why we're talking today.
Nice, nice. So you kind of came at Bitcoin from the same way that I did, from like an economic, Austrian economics kind of viewpoint.
Yeah.
So would you consider yourself like a Bitcoin maximalist? Like, what do you make of other cryptocurrencies like Dash or Litecoin? And what do you make of the hard forks on the Bitcoin network?
I mean, Bitcoin maximalist, pretty close to, I guess I would say at this point. My thinking has been evolving over time. I've definitely always been a Bitcoiner, and I've always held most of my wealth in Bitcoin since I learned about it and decided to, you know, devote my life to it, basically. But, you know, I bought some Ethereum actually on the crowd sale. And I was initially intrigued by that project. I think it's proven to have several fatal flaws, including sort of the cult of personality around Vitalik. The monetary policy does not seem to be fixed at all. What else? Well, the block size is, you know, growing close to exponentially from what I've seen. And that seems to be a big problem.
ETH 2.0 coming soon, indefinitely, running on AWS, that type of thing as well.
Right, right. And I think the foundation of all of this is that Bitcoin works because it's properly decentralized, or it's at least decentralized enough. Obviously, you know, more decentralization, I'm sure, would be better. But in terms of node count, Bitcoin is looking very healthy. And I could see a future where Ethereum is, you know, in 5 or 6 data centers, and that's it. And, you know, it'd be very easy for a couple governments to coordinate and shut it down completely. And no one would be able to do anything about that. So for people who are on the ETH train, I would say think long and hard about what decentralization is and why it's important. And I don't think Ethereum is really decentralized effectively at all. And so I've lost interest in Ethereum. I mean, I think their EVM, from what I understand, is the Ethereum virtual machine works fairly well as a piece of technology. I've played around with Solidity, and that's not a terrible language. So I think it's possible that some elements of Ethereum could survive. And I believe Rootstock, which is being built on top of Bitcoin, they are looking at, or maybe even integrating. I don't want to speak out of turn here because I'm not positive, but I know they've at least been looking seriously at using some parts of Ethereum in what they're building. So there's some interesting tooling that's gone on. I think right now I look at Ethereum as kind of like a nerd toy, basically. And really that's all that I would say it is and probably ever could be. It's definitely not lived up to what they were hoping, I think, or what they were aspiring to. And I think also, as I've, you know, so I've gotten into software development in the last couple of years, last, I guess, 6 or 7 years now, it's been a while, but, as I've gotten further and further into learning about software development and growing as a developer, I've seen that, you know, systems that work well in the wild are typically fairly simple, and that we have layered infrastructure. So the internet is a great example. You know, we have TCP/IP, and then we have HTTP, and then we have SMTP. So we have all these different protocols that work together, but they are all, in many ways, fairly simple and are built to serve a specific purpose, and that's it. And so Ethereum, to me, seems like it is trying to do too much, and that in trying to bite off too much, it's ultimately just not going to do anything. Whereas with Bitcoin, we have a fairly simple scripting setup and a small amount of primitives, but those are enough to allow us to build a sound financial system, and for us to have money that we know is not going to be inflated, that is not going to, the monetary policy isn't going to change because a couple developers or a couple founders, you know, just have a change of heart or vote about it or whatever. It's pretty much set in stone at this point, and I think that's good. It's ossifying, as the saying is. In terms of the forks, I think initially I was a little bit sympathetic to the Bitcoin Cash fork, because it did feel like, well, maybe there was a compromise. Maybe we could have gone to 2 megabyte blocks and it wouldn't have been the end of the world. And it was frustrating to see, to see the Bitcoin adoption just kind of hit a wall there I guess it was 2017. That was frustrating. You know, it's not fun to see the fees going up to $50 or so per transaction, and just kind of that grinding to a halt of the network was frustrating. And so I could see people moving in that direction, but I think ultimately they've been proven wrong. Scaling on chain is not a good idea for a lot of reasons, and we don't need to get into all of those right now. But the biggest one being that I think for the network to remain decentralized, if the requirements to run a node are too onerous, then we're going to have fewer and fewer nodes, and so effectively we could end up with an Ethereum type situation for Bitcoin Cash. And I mean, BSV is just complete garbage, and Craig Wright is a fraud, and I don't even want to talk about that stuff. I mean, if you're into that, you're either deluded or retarded, or I don't know what to say, but Craig Wright is a fucking idiot.
Yeah, well, I think
that's that.
I don't know, Josh. I think this is a good time to transition to the show here. That was a good way to end that part.
Yeah, okay. From that nuanced point at the end to into the show, one thing I've got written down here is orange coin good, dirty cotton bad. So that was pretty interesting. You did a presentation or a talk somewhere. It was on YouTube, and that was one of the slides. So that was a pretty good way to start, I think. I think that's a nice play on words from Orange Man Bad. A lot of people talk about Donald Trump, Orange Man Bad. So really? Orange Coin Good and Dirty Cotton Bad, that was pretty good. Dirty Cotton being, you know, the US dollar, the $100 bills, all of the fiat money in circulation made out of cotton. So that was pretty interesting. So essentially you decided to get involved in this project, and I don't know if you only are the executive producer or if you have other hands in the show, like you do a bit of the writing, you do a bit of the voiceovers. I'm not entirely sure. Maybe we could get into that. So what inspired you to get involved in Bitcoin and Friends, and like how did that all start?
So I have been producing the show with my brother and a few others, but Chris and I are kind of the two primary creators of the show. And he approached me about 2 years ago at this point with the idea for the show. He had this concept of a cartoon and of Bitcoin puking up the 10-minute block reward. Yeah, so those were some of the initial ideas that Chris had that he came to me with. And then we started riffing on, just expounding on that and thinking about some of the fun characters we could bring into the show, some of the actual, humans that have been involved in Bitcoin and some of the very colorful people that we could lampoon and have fun with. And so it became apparent to both of us that it was a good enough idea that we should pursue it. And so then we started working on the story ideas and, you know, story arcs and the season outlines and stuff together. Some of the character sketches. Chris did most of the actual writing of the episodes, although I have done a bit of writing in some of the episodes, including episode two, like a lot of the economic stuff and some of the more technical stuff where I'm a little more well-versed. I've been able to kind of throw in my ideas and help shape the episodes. But yeah, so it's been a collaboration. Chris and Jake, who's another producer of the show and very involved, they do the voices, most of the voices. I've done a few small like one or two line character voices, but generally speaking, I haven't been doing the voicing. The last episode four, I actually did most of the animation. And so that was interesting because we'd been paying for frame by frame animation and we were paying several different animators in the Philippines and a few other places. And it typically takes for a good animator, takes them about a week to do 1 minute of animation. And, you know, the cost can be $400 to $600 or so. And that's very low. I mean, cause you know, compared, like if we're hiring just US animators, it'd be several thousand probably per minute. So we're finding really the most economical way to do it. And even still, we were spending upwards of $10,000 on just the animation for these episodes. The first episode, I think we put out a total of like $45,000 to produce. And some of that was, you know, learning curve where we definitely could have cut some costs. But anyway, so, you know, frame by frame is how we've been doing the show. And then as we started getting into producing the show, I found this Adobe character animator program, which was spun off from After Effects. But basically it allows you to use your camera from your phone or sorry, from your computer camera and some other elements to effectively manipulate a puppet. And so I can do with character animator, I can do a minute of animation in a couple hours as opposed to like a week if you're doing it frame by frame style. And so that's been interesting. You know, of course, there's some challenges there to make the animation styles match. And it took us a while of, you know, kind of playing around. If you look at some of the early vlog videos that we were doing, these were like 1 or 2 minute short little clips. You can see those were all done with Character Animator from the beginning. And the animation style is a bit different, especially at the beginning. And so it took us a while to kind of get the styles to match. But, you know, I'm pretty proud of what we did with episode four in terms of the animation. I think given the cost, you know, I think we spent maybe a total of $4,000 on that. Wow. As opposed to 10, you know, 10 or more.
It's a lot less.
Yeah. So that's a big step in the right direction because, you know, bottom line is it's been amazing producing the show and the response has been generally very good. But the one frustration is that it appears that YouTube has not been happy for some reason with our content and our view counts have been dropping. Basically every episode has dropped considerably from one before that. And really the only explanation, well, there's possibly two explanations. Either A, you know, we have been writing consistently shittier episodes and people don't like the show, or B, YouTube has decided to throttle our incoming, you know, views for some reason.
Yeah. Well, let me give you some feedback there because, me and Josh, our show is much smaller, yeah. But you know, we have a BitChute and also a YouTube channel, and we release some of the back catalog on BitChute, and most of the episodes have 4 times the views of the YouTube channel.
Yeah, YouTube's algo is a bit odd these days. I don't know what's happened. It's becoming a bit more like, I don't know, Cade likes to say it's just like normal cable television or something like that. So if you wanted to watch cable TV, we'd just turn on the TV. But I don't know, so there's been some executive decisions in YouTube that haven't really gone the way of content creators, let's say that.
Right.
And that's probably that's driven, you know, the rise of these alternative channels. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other social media channels out there we could talk about, but
By the way, are you on like BitChute and like Library and these other alternative streaming platforms? That might be a good idea.
So yeah, we've been on Library since pretty far back now, and I think we have 2,500 or so subscribers on there. So it's about a tenth of our YouTube subscribers, but that's still not terrible. I think the view counts are pretty low on there, though. It's you know, the problem with these platforms, and it sounds like maybe BitChute is doing a little bit better, is that they typically just don't have much in the way of viewers and audience. And so, we've moved in that direction a little bit, but I guess we should probably take a closer look at BitChute. So I'm glad to hear that you guys have been, you know, seeing good view counts on there. Worth checking out.
Yeah, check it out. I want to comment a little bit what you said a little bit earlier. There's a lot to digest there with what you said about the show and starting to do your own animations and a lot of other stuff. But, you know, obviously I'm a big fan of the show. I invited you on. I'm actually, people can't see it, but I'm actually rocking the Bitcoin and Friends tee right now.
Nice. Awesome.
But I would describe the show, it's got a little bit of everything. I would describe it as like a mysterious, comedic, historic, action-packed, music-filled, educational infotainment. That's how I would pitch it if you want to throw that out there.
I like that. But, do you have that written down? Maybe you could send that to me and I'll...
I will send it to you in the chat. But I want to know, like, you know, obviously it's very funny. I like the animations. You know, honestly didn't know that there was a different... You were using a different animation style. It was so seamless, I couldn't really tell.
It's good to hear.
But I really liked how... I want you to give your feedback on two things. One, I really like how it's still like gritty and it's like politically incorrect a little bit. It's not afraid to take on the banks and, like, you know, kind of be a little South Parky, a little Family Guy-ish. Sure. But you also really drop these cryptographic red pills in the episodes. I'm especially thinking of episode one with Vitalik. And like you mentioned earlier in episode two, you're bringing up maybe obscure references that not everyone would get, like the Liberty Dollar or Freedom Fest in New Hampshire. Sure. But I wanted you to comment on like the style of having it be gritty and like talk about drugs and, you know, there's murders and all kinds of stuff. And also like wanting to actually like give maybe what I would call the normies a little bit of knowledge, people that really aren't deep into the crypto space.
I think it's really, it's nice. One of the benefits of getting older is that you've got more in your brain to work with. You have more memories, you have more history that you can pull from. And so, you know, I think working in the gold industry for a while and finance, living in New York, obviously digging pretty deeply into Austrian economics and libertarianism, all of these things are, you know, I'm able to draw from and help kind of shape, I guess, the feel and the direction of the show. So maybe it's a reflection of me to some degree, and of course of Chris as well. And you know, obviously Chris and I are brothers, so I think we see a lot of things pretty similarly. We're pretty close ideologically, I would say. I don't know if he's quite as far down the rabbit hole of libertarianism as I am, but I would say he probably is at least you know, very sympathetic to most of those sorts of ideas.
There was a lot of background reading, obviously, that has gone into this, and I'm glad that we had this 30 minutes before we got into the show to go into your background, because it's evident throughout the show that you are well-read and widely read. Some of the things that I picked up in the show that definitely haven't been overlooked, so I'm glad that you included them. You included the Rhystones in the Economania. That was pretty interesting. So that really shows the depth of the history of knowledge of money that you have. And then also you've got graffiti of Fannie Mae with a banker urinating on somebody right in the first episode, which is a reference to being like... Well, it's a reference to the subprime loan crash that happened in 2007, 8, and 9, the recession that followed. So that's pretty interesting. Bitcoin B, he wakes up in New Jersey and it's somewhat of a dystopian world and nobody accepts Bitcoin at the time. And as you mentioned, people, he's spitting up Bitcoins every 10 minutes, and that's because of that's every 10 minutes or so there's a new block, and there is there, you know, the mining reward is Bitcoin. And we're coming up to the halving. So I think this is going to be a good point to talk about the halving a little bit. What do you think about the halving? Traditionally, people are pointing back, or historically, people are looking back and saying, oh, the halving is a great time for, I don't know, speculative investment. Do you believe that from now until May that we'll see a similar bull run that we've seen in the past? Or do you think that it's been, I don't know, priced in, as some people like to say?
It seems that the market is not very efficient for Bitcoin as of yet. I think it's still a very small market. So I don't think the halving has been priced in. Also, the last two times that the block reward was cut in half, I think it was between maybe, you know, 3 and 9 months roughly after that, where the price went parabolic. And so I think it's very possible. Obviously, this time could be different, but I'm betting that it will go up pretty tremendously in the next 12 to 18 months, I would say. It could be a little bit longer, obviously, but probably in that range. Every time this happens, the influx, or the, you know, the issuance of new coins is cut in half. And so, supply and demand tells us that as long as demand remains similar to how it's been, the supply is going to be cut in half. So the price is going to have to rise to account for that. And so that's exciting for anyone who's holding Bitcoin.
Definitely.
Well, we're hodling on the dark side
of the hodl moon.
There we go.
And another thing I'd like to ask you about is the characters. So one thing that I really wanted to know is, did Pete Pablo really do the voiceover? Was he really one of the voice characters? Or is that kind of a joke? Because how did you get that?
It is. It is actually Pete Pablo.
Wow.
It's kind of surreal because, you know, Chris and I listened to Petey, you know, growing up playing video games in our room, and we'd have Petey playing in the background, you know, so it's fun to see how these things kind of come full circle in life.
Did he have that song swinging around your head like a helicopter, like, yes, the white tee?
yes, exactly. And he's had a couple other hits. So we just, you know, we reached out to him, I guess to his manager at that point. And there was some interest, and we offered, some money per episode, and he agreed. And he's done a great job for us. We've really enjoyed having him on the show. With our budgets being quite a bit lower moving forward, we're going to have to see if we can renegotiate, because quite frankly, I don't think we can continue to pay him. Given our view count and everything, it's just not going to work to pay him what we've been paying him. So hopefully he likes the project enough. I mean, it's literally like a couple hours of his time, so it's not a huge, huge ask. Yeah. And perhaps he'll continue to do it. But yeah, we're going to sadly have to
you need to sell him try on to the renegotiate. Legacy. Sell him on the legacy aspect. Pete, it's for your legacy, boy. Say, Petey, you can do it, mate.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we'll see. But yeah, it's been fun. You know, it's honestly, the one thing that's odd about it is we did expect to get a little more traction, or just a little more interest in the project from him being involved. But I don't know. There's, you know, he's probably a little beyond his prime, you know, and I guess it's a big wide world out there. So, but yeah, nonetheless, it's been fun having him, and we really like his voice acting, and he's done a good job.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'm just surprised you guys haven't gotten more traction just from the crypto community. Some of the view counts, I'm a little surprised, because I feel like this is one of the better projects that's like pushing crypto. You know, people talk about like, well, one thing would be like a cartoon, which you've done, or a comic book, or, crypto music videos, or what are ways to get people that aren't really into Austrian economics or voluntarism or the non-aggression principle? How do we get these people involved in this and interested in it? And I think your project is one of the best. So
thank you.
Yeah,
it's been a little disheartening, to be honest, that we haven't had a little more excitement. I mean, granted, we've had a lot of people reach out and you know, we've received donations, and but given the size of the Bitcoin community in particular, it is a little odd. And I don't know. I wonder if perhaps people are you know, waiting on the fence to see the kind of posture we're going to take with certain people or certain coins, certain projects. And so maybe they don't want to get too involved because they're concerned. You know, for example, if you're a maximalist, maybe you're worried that we're going to give too much airtime to Ethereum or other projects. If you're an ETH head, maybe you don't like that we're so pro Bitcoin. So I don't know. I mean, and we had kind of hoped that the show would be a way to get people to come together and to kind of rally around our common goals again. Because I do think even for, you know, people into Ethereum, even though many of them, I think, are not educated about economics really much. And I think that's one of the big problems with that project. I still think there's a lot that we can offer each other and you know, our goals are not that divorced that we shouldn't be able to work together in some ways.
I think it's because of the Netflix culture that we live in. I mean, people are in this binge watching kind of mindset now. When they start to watch a show, they think, oh, I'm just going to watch the whole season. I'm going to watch the whole thing. And maybe people perhaps don't realize that it's a small team and that it's not entirely finished. I know that you talked about wanting to do potentially 3 seasons or even more.
Right.
But people perhaps don't realize that this isn't a project that's already had millions of dollars of funding and there's a big production team behind it. And I think that they assume that just because of the high quality of production that's out there in the episodes, they must, a lot of people think, all right, there must be 12 finished episodes already. And then they're like, why hasn't it been released? I'm used to watching everything on Netflix all at the same time. So perhaps does that disconnect in the culture? That's the only thing I can think of, because honestly, I was guilty of that too, because when I first saw the first episode, I thought, all right, well, next week I'm going to tune in and I'm going to be able to see the second episode. I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand that, you know, there's just you, your brother, and a couple of dedicated people. And at the time, it was in the Philippines doing some animation. So I think your success is double-edged in the sense that it was set such high expectations that everyone assumed that it was going to be all finished as the first episode was released, whereas we've discovered now that it's actually an ongoing project and it needs the support of the community. So if you're listening to this, make sure you, if you do support it, then go and send over some donations. I'm sure you're still accepting donations for the show. And I think that would be a really good thing that we could help promote too. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was...
Or buy a t-shirt.
Oh yeah, buy a t-shirt. Like Cade's rocking his t-shirt right
Love
now.
Love it, yeah.
Some of the other characters that you have are really funny, like Charlie Lee. It's pretty funny.
Sure.
Jameis Sapphire. That's pretty funny.
Right.
I mean... obviously, that's a reference to a certain banker who was against Bitcoin and then suddenly big fans of blockchain with their own blockchain.
Right.
So it's pretty hilarious, a lot of the references. It really does show that you're deeply involved in this. So for me, it's saying well done and thank you, because I definitely enjoyed the show and it appealed to people definitely like us, the dark side of the HODL Mooners. So thanks for producing it. I'm thinking about a few other questions that I wanted to get to. One was about the sponsors. So you were sponsored by Loom Network at one point, and I saw in the credits that you said thanks to AV Exchange. Now, I know a couple of the guys at AV Exchange in the Philippines, so that was a kind of a surprise to me as well that they were involved in the show somewhat. So that's cool. And then yesterday I was on the phone with Yuri Van Gielen, who's one of my colleagues, and he said that you know him really well. So that was a nice coincidence. It's a small world in the cryptosphere.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, and I think I'm glad you're bringing up some of these connections, because it is important to point out that we've had quite a few people reach out to be very supportive in different ways. And so, you know, huge thank you to everyone who has embraced us and the project. I believe AVX helped to fund some translations of some of the earlier episodes into a few languages, so we could have some subtitles. And we've had a lot of people donate their time to translate into other languages for subtitles, so that's been really nice to see. And to your earlier point, I think you're really spot on. I think we're all a bit spoiled in the Netflix age that we are in. And so, you know, people were expecting probably to see these 8 or 10 or however many episodes they thought be dropped and, you know, in quick succession. Unfortunately, we didn't have that huge budget. You know, it's flattering for people to think that we did, given the quality of the show. And I think that is maybe a testament to how hard we've worked on it and how much love we've put into it, because this really is a big labor of love for us. But yeah, there's been a ton of support. We need more of it. And, you know, so for anyone out there listening, as you said earlier, you know, try to support us if you can financially, buy a t-shirt, get the word out to your friends, show your friends and family the show. You know, the cool thing is, in terms of likes to dislikes on YouTube, I think pretty much everything we put out has been 95% plus upvoted. So that seems, you know, this is my first time in YouTube trying to do something like this, but that seems like a really high like to dislike ratio. So I think for those who do see the show, it tends to resonate and they tend to really enjoy it. But we just need to get the word out and get more people on board. And, you know, we have been pushing to try to find networks that might be interested in picking up the show. And there's still possibility that could happen. We did pitch recently to Sci-Fi Channel. And unfortunately, they passed, and we don't know why. We didn't really get any feedback, but we actually had some fairly big actors attached, including Snoop Dogg, and Orlando Jones also attached for that pitch. That would have been a slightly different version of the show, which would have been a episodic as opposed to serialized. So it would have been a little bit shorter episodes and slightly different format, but. Anyway, we'll see. You know, we're pushing. We've got an agent in Australia who's going to be going to some of these big industry events and trying to pitch the show to networks and streaming platforms. And so we're going to keep pushing. You know, it's I think anything worth doing is worth struggling for. And you know, so it's been a little bit of a struggle with the view count on YouTube dropping so much. But as long as we can continue to get sponsors for episodes, we're going to continue to produce the show. If you are involved with a Bitcoin or cryptocurrency company and you want to sponsor, right now we're really looking for, given that we've been able to cut our production costs, 5 to 10K is really all we need from a sponsor to be able to produce an episode. So it's not a huge outlay of money. You know, at the end of the day, even if you don't get a ton of traction, although of course we hope you will. But you'll be able to support something that you know, may go down in history, we hope, as kind of an iconic piece of the Bitcoin story. So yeah, help us make it, and let's do this together.
Nice.
That's so, my pitch.
Yeah, so you can buy shirts, you can go on Patreon, you can be a show sponsor, and also I don't know if this is still true, but like at one point you could, if you're a whale, you can donate and like be a character in one of the episodes. That's also an option.
Yeah, we're still doing that, and actually a couple of the characters in the show have been just that exact thing. So. It's been nice to find different ways to fund the project, and we're going to continue to be flexible. So if you want to be in the show, we're asking $2,500, which is not chump change, but you know, if you're a Bitcoin millionaire, it is chump change. So, you know, be immortalized on YouTube and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, so, I'll talk to some of the guys that I work with. I'm sure that we could look into this. That would be pretty cool. I'd love to get us on the show somehow, in one way or another. So
cool.
That would be awesome. One of the other things I wanted to ask you was, who was your favorite character? So I touched on a few of the others. I think Cade liked the reenactment dude that was playing Ross Ulbricht, I think, from the Silk Road. Because Cade, you've got a background in going to those type of reenactment places, I think. You're right. You've been to a couple of them. You said they're pretty fun, or people pretend that they're back in 1776 where you're trying to liberate yourself.
I'm familiar with them, Josh. I've never gone to one. I think you've been drinking a little bit too much soju
this morning. Allegedly you went, right?
Oh, okay. Maybe you didn't go. I thought that you're a big fan or that you go to, and they always have like a good selection of ales and stuff around there. Maybe.
Well, Maybe I go to some beer gardens. I don't know if I go to any like Civil War or Revolutionary War reenactments, but I do like a good lager from time to time.
Yeah. So who was your favorite character then? That's what I wanted to ask you. Who's your favorite character that you created?
Who's my favorite character? Oh my goodness, that's tough. Yeah, Ross is really a great character. It's very easy to be sympathetic to him and his goals. And, you know, we obviously go down the libertarian rabbit hole in terms of drug prohibition and all of that. And it should be very obvious what we think about all of that from the show. We should end the drug war tomorrow or today or as soon as possible. So Ross is great. I mean, oh gosh, I don't know. This is a tough question. I honestly really do love Charlie Lee. He's just, he's a lot of fun, alien controlled. And I really love Bitcoin, of course, for a lot of reasons. I think he's a very lovable character. He's got his kind of lispy, childlike, voice and way of approaching the world. Litecoin is also quite a bit of fun. That's a newish character that we brought in. So, I don't know. That's hard to pick a favorite, though. There's a lot of fun elements of the show. So I'm going to have to tap out and just say they're all great. I don't know. Like picking your favorite child, right? I mean,
yeah, we'll sit on the fence. Yeah. That's all right. You can stay on the fence. That's fine. All right. So this has been a really great episode. Thanks for coming on the show. Honestly, we were so surprised that you were so straightforward and like, yeah, sure, let's do it. That was really great of you to come on.
Cool.
My pleasure. We hope that we covered a lot of the interesting points that could have come up. If we've missed anything, we'll have to do a second episode sometime in the future, perhaps in 6 months or a year. And hopefully you've received a massive amount of funding from a big TV channel or something like that. I'd recommend approaching some of the British channels because they're open to lots of dark humor. If you approach maybe Channel 4 or Channel 5, some of the evening shows post 10 p.m., I'm sure that you'd be able to pick up a slot somehow.
Interesting.
Have a look at that. And Cade, what are your thoughts? Have you got anything to add before we start to wrap this up?
No, I'm just really happy with how the interview went. It was really exciting to hear your backstory. You know, a lot of interviews you only hear about talking about the show, but I kind of wanted to hear about your history prior to the show, and I thought it was very interesting. So I think I'm going to leave the BTC and Friends producer with the last words. You can tell us anything else about sponsoring the show, or do you have other episodes already pre-made? Or do you see it going beyond 3 seasons if it gets the funding? Just I'll leave you with the last word and we'll link the show in the show notes and we'll wrap it up there.
Excellent. Well, you know, at this point, 3 seasons is a lot of work. So I think that's probably plenty to bite off for now, assuming we can continue to roll forward with funding. But you never know. I really love the world that we're creating and the characters. And, you know, obviously it should be very apparent that I'm obsessed with Bitcoin and have been for years. So, you know, this project is like a dream come true for me to be able to work on something that I care so passionately about and hopefully to inspire and encourage people to learn about Bitcoin and economics and Austrian economics and money and all of these things. Yeah, I mean, this was a real pleasure, guys. So thank you, Josh and Cade. Happy to come back again anytime. And thanks again.
You're welcome.
All right. Great. Well, Josh and Blockade will be watching episode 5 from the dark side
of the Huddle Moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehuddlemoon.com.
Huddle Moon!